everyone.
Blog Talk Radio.
I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I'm very excited that tonight we are going to be having a special on judicial accountability and the jury trial. There are several people who have already called in. I'm not sure if either of you are Catherine Hine or Aubrey Ellen Shomo. So just so you know that we tend to have some technical difficulties with the number line. So it's either star 1 or 1 to flag me to let me know that you would like to talk. And so if you would press either star 1 or 1, if Catherine Hine or Aubrey Ellen Shomo is on the line. So this show tonight is going to focus on judicial accountability and the jury trial. And I'm very excited about this because I think it's one of the main issues that people are up against in trying to get even a fair hearing for what it is that we're subjected to in terms of psychiatry when there's a court order in place. And so I think that it's really very important that people are brought up to date about this. The show, I'm hoping that our guest is going to call in soon, but just as we're waiting, I wanted to just give a couple of updates about different activities going on and remind people that Bastille Days is the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day Vigil is going to be in Albany, New York, from July 13th through July 16th, where people will be sitting and holding vigil to break the silence about psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit. This will be happening on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And again, that will be July 13th through the 16th. And the Alliance can be reached at area code 800-654-7227. That's area code 800-654-7227. And also, Mind Freedom International's 2014 Creative Revolution Conference will be held July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And the keynote speakers include Robert Whitaker, who wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America, and Mary Ellen Copeland of the Wellness Recovery Action Planning, RAP plans. And they'll have five tracks, and these will include Hearing Voices, Soteria House, Open Dialogue, Peer Respite, and Coming Off of Psychiatric Drugs. And so if you would like more information about Mind Freedom International's Creative Revolution Conference, you can find that out at mindfreedom.org. Okay, I'm just going to open lines here for a second. If any of you are, just in case we're having these technical difficulties, if Catherine Hine or Aubrey or Ellen Shomo, are you on any of these lines?
I am on. This is Aubrey.
Okay, and you're calling from what area code?
336.
336.
Oh, no, actually, it's probably 720 on your screen.
720. Okay, great. And Catherine, are you online here? Okay, I'm going to put the others on hold if you'd like to join in the conversation at any point. Let me know. Aubrey, maybe we can start with if you would give an introduction of who you are and what you're doing and why what you're doing is relevant to people.
Sure. I am a psychiatric survivor. I am from the Colorado area originally. Where a law domestically is at the moment. So I also recently was a World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry delegate to the United States ICCPR review.
Would you just back up, because I'm for people who might not know what any of those acronyms are, would you spell out
sure.
what that is?
The ICCPR is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and we were attempting to get the United Nations to declare, and it was myself, Tina Minkowitz, and Patricia Bowerly from the United States, and then we also had the support of other World Network folks from Europe while we were there. And we were trying to get the United Nations to declare that forcible treatment is a violation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights as a form of torture or other ill treatment. We were not fully successful, but we did get a concluding observation that said that any involuntary treatment should be subjected to independent review, and that it should be not long-term, and that it should be as limited as possible. And they also said where absolutely necessary for the benefit of the person. Obviously, we object to the notion that it can be simultaneously forcible and beneficial. But that was the conclusion that we got out of it. And so one thing of note is that especially in the American democracy, but really worldwide, the jury trial is the highest form of independent review. And it's a right that the use of is unfortunately either very hard to do because you basically have to know about it and agitate for it yourself. Nobody is going to suggest it. Or sometimes almost impossible to access. So that's one of the key issues. And then also recently, in the state of Colorado, they had proposed a bill, House Bill 2014, number 1253, that would actually remove the jury trial from civil commitments. Its primary sponsor was Representative McCann, a Democrat from House District 8.
This is urgently important for people who may not know what's going on or just are tuning in. There was a bill put forward that attempted in Colorado that attempted to remove the right to a jury trial for people who were being forcibly involved with psychiatry.
Correct. In Colorado, it's always a civil commitment. The court can be petitioned to have that done on an outpatient basis, but any kind of forcible involvement with psychiatry that the state isn't doing unlawfully or, you know, obviously if you're under a guardianship or you're a minor, a ward of the state, or your parents are against you, then exactly at what point that becomes a civil commitment versus what point it happens under your parents' consent is another issue. But this bill tried to take away the right to a jury trial for anybody subjected to civil commitment. And
so this would be for any adult?
For any adult and actually a number of teenagers.
Okay.
Not necessarily for younger children, but my understanding is past the age of 15, anybody has the right to refuse consent, and at which point they're typically committed and rarely receive any sort of due process rubber stamp. And they had tried to remove this right thinking, you know, it's possibly underutilized because you really have to go out of your way and know it's there to make use of it. We were able to stop them. We did a massive robo-dialing campaign against the sponsor's district. And the reason I want you to remember the name of the sponsor, Beth McCann or Elizabeth McCann, is because it was the feeling of the campaign to stop her, and it's my personal feeling, that the only way politicians are going to stop basically coming after our rights or being harmful to us is if they're afraid of losing their jobs over it. And so I think everybody should remember and everybody should tell everyone they know Beth McCann went after the jury trial, and thankfully she failed. But, you know, there's an election coming up. She's in the House. She's up for election every 2 years. This is her last term in the House. After this, she might try to go on to something else, perhaps higher office. And so it's very important everybody remember this is the person that came after the jury trial rights of our people.
So, and that's McCann, right? Beth McCann, who went after the jury trial. So I'm just, if you could position this a little bit from a perspective of the movement and from what a robocall is for people who may not know, or how you came up with this strategy, or just to give a little bit of fuller, but especially from the movement perspective of why is this so important in so many levels, and then how does this affect just every American with the idea that a jury trial can be ripped out like that.
And then that's something that not everybody has really really understood in the movement. A lot of folks are incredibly despondent and dejected and say it doesn't matter in court, we'll lose. And you will always lose in court. So the jury trial, some people think, is sort of a red herring, but it's really not. The jury trial historically has been the fundamental mechanism whereby the citizens control what the state can and can't do to people. So if someone is refusing treatment, you know the judge is just going to rubber stamp it. It doesn't matter. The judge will not side with you. They'll side with the experts who happen to also be the people who filed the petition to certify you. Your only chance might be to hire your own independent expert at the tune of $4,000 every time they file on you. And then, you know, have an attorney and go through the whole process. But even then, you have much better odds of getting a reasonable, fair result, such as being able to contest the fact that you're being detained with a jury of your peers. The biggest reason for that is these are not people who have been hardened. Judges who hear mental health cases are used to them. They're used to rubber stamping people's freedom away who haven't committed any crimes, who may not even be displaying anything other than symptoms of a mental illness. And so you just have to ask yourself, would you rather take your chances with somebody who at least hasn't become hardened to the use of power, or would you rather have your fate decided by somebody whose job is to rubber stamp lockup petitions? That's where the jury trial is essential. If you want to fight a commitment, you're not going to win any other way.
I think that this is really important for people to understand. And this idea of the despondency that people have about the court process and about the lack of true information that's given to people in this. I'm just going to open up a line here that's an internet-based line, just in case there are some issues. If Catherine Hine is on this line, can you hear me? If Catherine, this is you? Okay. I know I'm getting some messages from people in the from the internet that there may be some technical issues with people accessing the show and the calls, and so hopefully that this will be getting resolved soon. But I think that, you know, the idea that you can go to court and that there is a judge who has already made a backroom deal with a prosecuting attorney and supposedly your defense attorney, that then further encroaches you into the psychiatric system is just really the, I think, the standard that people are set to. And one of the things
it doesn't even need to be a backroom deal, though, because the judge is so callous, they don't need to do any, untoward actions that would somehow allow you to challenge the case later. They'll just rubber stamp anything. So pretty much if the city files it, you are detained, or if the county files it. In Colorado, anyways, it's either the city and county or the county that you're in files the petition. And so there doesn't need to be a backroom deal with the judge and the appointed counsel and the prosecutor or anything else. All it takes is the filing, and then there's the implicit assumption that you will be certified and that your certification will be upheld. I mean, in Colorado, just to get a hearing on a certification, you have to file paperwork to request it. You don't just get one.
Right. So would you, right. And so, I mean, I watched your posts as you were going through this whole process and trying to call attention to the loss of the jury trial or the potential loss of the jury trial for people in Colorado. Would you talk a little bit about step by step of what it is you actually did so that people who may be interested in doing this kind of legislative advocacy would then maybe have some insight into how to go about doing these things?
Sure. I mean, basically, the first thing I did when I realized they were coming after the jury trial is I thought to myself, I can't believe they think they're going to get away with this. I mean, I have had the bias. I had a very good social studies teacher in school, and when I was younger, I actually believed him about how our system works, that said things like that wouldn't even be conscionable. They shouldn't be thinkable to politicians. But in Colorado, after the Aurora Theater shooting, and the plan was announced immediately after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, the governor came up and said, we're going to revamp civil commitment. And I believe he was doing it pretty much because he was looking for a political way to distinguish himself. And we were the group of people that they could move on and they could get away with it because they didn't think we had any political power to stop them with. And they were so willing to do it that they included this. The bill, House Bill 1253, doesn't just take the jury trial away. It completely redid the civil commitments procedure, but its worst feature took the jury trial away. Now, they had already gotten some pushback from the gun lobby. But the thing is, it looked like even in the best case from the gun lobby's pushback, they were likely to wait out the election year and come back and do it again. And as soon as we had a poll that was going to a jury trial, it occurred to me that the only way to stop them for all time is basically to out this politician for what she's doing, what she's thinking, and to make sure that what scares them about coming for our rights is being seen coming for our rights. That's something that will actually change a politician. Meeting with your politician, meeting with your representative, meeting with your senator is great. But the purpose of that is mostly just to give you a pat on the head. The same thing is true about testifying before Congress. For the most part, they've already decided what they're going to do, and the testimony phase at the hearing is a dog and pony show. That was especially true in Colorado because this was a majority party initiative. The governor was a Democrat. The House of Representatives was thoroughly controlled by Democrats. The House Health Insurance and Environment Committee, where the bill was heard, has a one-vote Democratic majority, as is typical when a party controls a House. The Senate, likewise, the Judiciary Committee, which is where a later version of the bill was heard, there's a one-point majority there, and the Democrats controlled the Senate by one vote. So since this was a party leadership initiative, this is basically something the ruling party got together and said, we're going to make this law. There was very little that could stop them other than getting them to be afraid that their own base, liberal voters, Democrats, you know, I'm transgendered, I'm a registered independent, but I've always voted with liberal leaning, so I understood these guys. And it hurt me all the more what they were doing as a result. So I made the decision as soon as I heard about it. I had just been at the United Nations for the ICCPR review, and I got a phone call from home, emergently saying, to take the jury. So I figured the best way to get them to stop, and not just this year, not just right now, but for as long as possible, is to show them what coming after our rights can do to them. The reason they think they can do whatever they want to us is because they think crazy people lack power. Now, I can't go into precisely the details of how I made the robocalling happen.
Okay, I want you to stop for 1 second, though, because I think you just made an incredibly, incredibly urgent point that we need to continue to highlight about the idea that people who are psychiatrically labeled lack power. And And if we all came together as a voting bloc, what that could potentially do. I think that this is really so urgent that we pay attention to that we do have power, and that that is a falsity inside of that. So I just feel like anything you can say more about that also would be really important.
Well, I will underscore that with the following statistic. According to the National Institutes of Mental Health, and this is a statistic even our opposition brings out. Representative Murphy trotted this statistic out left and right, and he was trying to expand involuntary outpatient treatment. According to the statistics from the National Institutes of Mental Health, 26.2% of the American public will suffer from a diagnosable mental illness in a given year. Now, if you think about the structure of a commitment law, the only thing that's special about it is that you have a mental illness. They tend to require two things, that you have a mental illness and that you meet some other criteria which make you committable. But those other criteria don't apply to you if you're just an ordinary Joe in the street. They don't apply to you if you're in any other minority group. They only apply to you if you have a mental illness. What's critical, that's a 26% voting bloc. That's a voting bloc as large as any other minority that scares them.
Right, 26% of the population that is generally subjected to the fraud of psychiatry. I know we don't necessarily agree on all of this, but 26% of the people who are of American population who are being labeled with something that there is no actual physical evidence for its existence. And then how many of those people then forcibly subjected to
In a recent year, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 33,000 people in the state of Colorado were subjected to this. Now, that is an awful lot of people. When we sent out the messaging, we said they're taking the jury trial from a million people. Colorado has a population of 5 million, and it was just easier to say a million than a million point 25. Which is actually 1,000,125, which is more 1.25 million, which is more accurately the number of people who are at risk. And so you've got a million people who are at risk by the government saying you have a diagnosable mental illness. 30,000 of these people, which is a significant percentage, it's much higher than the percentage of people, I believe. I would have to verify this, so don't quote me on it. That are generally subject to the criminal law and then actually subjected to a criminal proceeding. So this is a special law with a disproportionate group of people being subjected to a loss of rights under it. And the difference between the 30,000 and the million is primarily socioeconomic. If you are in a position to come to the state's attention, or if you have a family that brings you to the state's attention, then these laws if you're able to avoid the state's notice, then that's your only chance to not be subjected. And so that's where we get the difference between the 1 million folks at risk and the 30,000 folks who are actually involved in these sorts of proceedings in a given year in Colorado.
And 30,000
socioeconomic factor.
Yeah, and I'm imagining 30,000 votes could probably swing a decision one way or the other in Colorado, right?
If they were all in one place, 30,000 votes would take Beth McCann out of office, and she tends to win with 87% of the vote in her district because it's a largely central city Democratic district.
Right. Area code 210, your line is open, so you're live on air. Did you have a question or comment, or are you Catherine?
Hi, this is Wayne Ramsey. I'm calling from Texas. I'd like to thank Garvey for all his comments. I agree with him, everything he said. I'd like to call your attention to a webpage that you may not be aware of. I see it hasn't been updated for a long time. It's put online in 2000, but it's a webpage that describes the right to jury trial in all 50 states and also discusses commitment law in Canada. It's antipsychiatry.org/jury.htm. I think it's titled Your Right to Jury Trial in Psychiatric Civil Commitment. and it reviews the laws, states' laws that existed at that time in all 50 states.
Huh.
And you'll see, according to that, when I just looked at it, that it shows that there is a right to jury trial in Colorado. I'm disappointed to hear somebody try to get rid of it. I'm glad that bill didn't pass. If you count the number of states that guarantee the right to jury trial and civil commitment, I see there's 19 states and the District of Columbia, but they include the largest states, California, Texas, and New York. And so actually a majority of the U.S. population does have a right to jury trial and civil commitment for supposed mental illness.
So, Wayne, can I just interrupt you again? That's antipsychiatry.org/...
Jury, J-U-R-Y.
Just /jury. Okay.
Jury.htm.
Jury.htm. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Now, I'd also like to tell you, I'm an attorney, and I've been putting together a web page. I've been publishing a book on the Internet, and anybody who wants to is welcome to look at WayneRamsay.com. That's WayneRamsay.com. Spell it E-Y, you'll get a real estate agent, Keller Williams or something. And I have a number of essays. They're online right now, basically debunking the concept of mental illness. The essays are titled, Does Mental Illness Exist? Schizophrenia, a Non-Existent Disease? The Myth of Biological Depression? The Myth of Psychiatric Diagnosis? And Why the Myth of Mental Illness Lives On? I'm reformatting the other essays for that website, and they'll be posted as soon as they're prepared.
Can you give that website again, Wayne?
WayneRamsay.com. WayneRamsay.com.
Got it. Great. Thanks. Maybe perhaps sometime you would like to come on and talk a little bit deeply about your website and what people could find on it. Just looking quickly at it, it looks like a resource.
I might want to add, the right to jury trial is really quite critical to avoiding involuntary commitment, and it's sad that it only exists for a little more than half of the people in the United States. Even where it exists, though, it's generally ignored. I think it was 2010, I got the numbers for Bexar County, Texas, which includes San Antonio. And out of something like over 2,000 or 3,000 commitments, only one was tried by a jury. And the reason this happens is the attorneys who do this kind of work seem to discourage people from demanding the right to jury trial. And yet, without it, it's very difficult to, almost impossible, to be released. Last year, I was in New York in a courtroom. I was appearing as amicus curiae. On behalf of a person being committed against her will, and we did persuade her to contest her commitment, and a judge did release her. I also saw a judge release somebody in San Antonio last September. I've watched what about 8 hearings there, and at San Antonio State Hospital, one of the 8 was released. It's not totally impossible to get a judge to persuade a judge to release people. It's happening more than it used to. Back in the 1970s, I looked at this, and I watched hundreds of people committed, and nobody was ever released by the judge as long as the 2 physician certificates were on file with the court. So the judges tend, as Aubrey was saying, the judges tend to rubber stamp commitments, and if you don't have a right to jury trial, it's practically impossible to dispute it. I would suggest to everybody that they have a psychiatric advance directive declining all treatment for mental illness. Mental illness is, in fact, a completely invalid concept. It doesn't exist any more than evil spirits or curses by gods. I review all the evidence for that in those essays that I mentioned. I hope this is helpful.
It is helpful, and I thank you for calling in, and perhaps that we can, you know, through your website, maybe I can get in touch with you, and maybe we can do something a little bit more specifically, because I think, you know, from a lawyer's perspective of working on this and how you've seen it work or not, I also think that the advance directives are incredibly important for people to have and put together. And so that's also a really good point. Aubrey, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this.
Well, I had one thought that I was thinking of breaking in with first. And one thing I would suggest is I'm not a lawyer. This comes from just looking at how people respond to folks, so take it with what it's worth. But I wouldn't think challenging the validity of the concept of mental illness in a psychiatric advance directive proper is likely to go well, simply because it's likely to be used by the doctors, by the people trying to lock you up, as evidence you can't think properly. Regardless of how the scientific discussion goes, it's one of those claims that simply making it deprives you of credibility. So, I would simply add that having an advance directive is critical. Having a medical durable power of attorney is critical. But I would focus it on reasons to not, A, that you refuse the treatment, and B, if you are to provide reasons for refusing the treatment, keep in mind that you want these to be reasons that a judge or a jury who's not familiar with our movement, who's not familiar with any of these issues, to be able to immediately accept.
Right.
Can I respond to that?
That's a really interesting point. And I just, the phone lines are lighting up. So if you stay online, I just want to say area code 212, your line is open.
Hey, it's. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, it's Jake Minas calling in. I'm excited about this episode because it seems like a lawyer's guild. Wayne, I haven't met you before, but I'm a corporate attorney at a big firm in New York, and I'm excited. Is Catherine Hine on?
Not yet. We're trying to get her through, and so hopefully very shortly she will be joining us.
Okay, cool. I read some stuff on the Ohio Supreme Court case, or at least I skimmed the complaint. And Wayne, I was listening into some things you were saying, one thing I wanted to pick your brain about, and is first of all, if you could tell me how to spell your name. I was just trying to look you up on Martindale Hubbell.
Well, I don't know if I'm in Martindale Hubbell or not, but you can find it online. WayneRamsay. I'm a member of the State Bar of Texas.
Texas. Okay. Yeah. So one thing you said that interested me, that I was thinking the same way, is that you said, it's not a smart idea to go into to a hearing, with a wholesale anti-psychiatry defense, like, you know, coming in preaching like Thomas Sowers or whatever, and just saying there's no such thing as mental illness. It's all a social concept and, you know, whatever. I thought the same thing, but I spoke to a guy, Toby Watson. Do you know who he is?
No.
He is I don't know what the alphabet soup of credentials means, but he's a PsyD, a PsyD, which makes me understand
that's
that he's
a psychologist. Yeah, that's a psychologist who's done instead of doing research, you do a clinical where you actually are practicing underneath another psychologist, a PsyD.
Yeah, so what he said is that, you know, he provides expert testimony, and he said that he's been successful with, you know, what we call a collateral attack, like an anti-psychiatry collateral attack. Like, he will go in and say things like, if you're given a DSM code, he will, you know, first, you know, work within the code and say, well, you know, the state expert has not checked all the boxes for this particular disorder, which is acknowledging, the authority of the DSM. But he will also go in and say things like, you know, this is all made up. I mean, he'll say it in a more fancy pants academic way, but he'll say that, you know, this is a social construction. You know, if you look at the introduction of the DSM, it says that, you know, we don't have any test for anything. He will pick on the fact that, there's an ever growing, overlapping, list of ailments, including, you know, the infamous NOS ailment. And he says that can work. I understand that that can work coming from someone with psychiatric credentials as opposed to, you know, a crazy person who's opposing treatment to them saying the same thing. But he says that there is a way to make that case, and to the point you keep making, especially in front of a jury.
Well, now, the point that Aubrey made about it, that kind of argument depriving you of credibility in the eyes of many, I have heard that before. In fact, in preparing a brief, another attorney made that same point to me. It was Jim Gottstein. He said that you're going to lose credibility if you make an argument against the concept of mental illness. And I suppose you would lose credibility in 1692 if you made an argument against the concept of witchcraft. However, it's necessary to speak the truth, and the truth is that mental illness is a myth. It doesn't exist in a biological sense. It doesn't even exist in a social sense, except as a way of expressing disapproval of somebody's behavior. And perhaps with combined with the idea that, you know, I don't know why this person is doing this. And so I'm going to create this concept of mental illness to explain what I don't understand and give me the feeling of understanding. And certainly you can just say, okay, we'll accept the concept of mental illness is valid and just criticize the use of psychiatric drugs and show how they're all harmful and show the fact that nobody should ever use any of them. I mean, the insanity that goes on in the courtrooms around the country today, 90% of it is psychiatrists trying to get people to take their so-called medication, the patients trying to avoid taking it. And the fact of the matter is, there was no such thing as a good psychiatric drug. All these very intelligent people are so wrapped up in this big charade about trying to get people to take their medication as if psychiatry actually had medication. It's bizarre. I've taken the copies of Peter Bregan's Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry and then mailed copies of them to judges and mental health public defenders to try to make them understand that, you know, that psychiatry doesn't have any medication.
That is a good point. Let me give you another collateral attack that I know that the Gottstein recommends, which is the Whitaker affidavit. You know, if you file the Whitaker affidavit in court, you're not saying that this patient doesn't need neuroleptics or they would not be indicated for his particular purported mental illness. You're just saying the Whitaker affidavit says neuroleptics don't work. And if they work, they work by inflicting temporary and permanent brain damage, like the new lobotomy. That's another collateral attack. If you can file that and get it expertized, then you're saying you're effectively pushing for a ruling that that no one should be forcibly prescribed neuroleptics.
You keep using the term collateral attack. Collateral attack, and I think of it in the legal sense of when you file a lawsuit to attack a previous judgment. You mean it in a different sense, obviously.
Okay, you caught me out. I'm not a real lawyer. I just do deal documents.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, regardless, though, of whether it's technically a collateral attack or not, I think it's worth noting that it can be actually used very much in the direct proceeding, and a document like that can be used as part of a strategy. And again, I'm not a lawyer. There are certainly very particulars with the law. But one thing that my work involves is knowing what I can sell to the voting public, which is at least somewhat related to what you might be able to sell to a jury once what you can introduce has been decided. And in that sense, what I would suggest is that a frequent question that comes up in forcible medication issues is whether the person can make a rational decision. And as has been noted, a lot of the time, the very fact that someone is refusing medication is taken as a sign or construed by the adverse party, the state, as a sign that the person is not acting rationally. So if you bring in something like the Whitaker affidavit, if you bring in an issue like psychiatric drugs cause people harm, that can actually be compelling standing on its own. That argument is the argument we were making at the ICCPR at the UN. Our primary argument had nothing to do with scientific and diagnostic criteria, although that was mentioned in the shadow report. The primary argument was that these drugs harm people, and that makes a person who wants to refuse them Very possibly acting rationally, even if you try to construe whatever it is they're saying as irrational. So that harmfulness aspect can really prop up somebody's refusal, even if you're not going to go in and try and make a claim that's already stopped, like commitment laws are intrinsically invalid, which I don't know. I'd be curious when Ramsey's position on this, but at least if you try to do that from a due process perspective with the existing precedent in federal courts, if you tried to completely attack the commitment law, I would think you'd be more likely to be sanctioned than anything else.
Attacks on commitment law have been rarely successful. Occasionally, it's been possible to attack them on procedural grounds. By the way, the use of affidavits, you need to understand that, generally speaking, an affidavit is not going to be admissible in a trial. I remember Jim Gottstein once making the remark at a NARPA conference, that's National Association for Rights Protection Advocacy, that these affidavits, like I think her name is Grace Jackson, a psychiatrist who wrote a book titled Rethinking Psychiatric Drugs, she's made out some affidavits. People tried to get them introduced in evidence in commitment hearings, and I'd be surprised if you were able to do that because they need that witness needs to be available for cross-examination or it's hearsay evidence. And so what you really need is for those witnesses, those expert witnesses, to be available in the town where you are, and good luck. I mean, I have tried to get expert witnesses on behalf of patients, and it is extremely difficult. I mean, trying to get Peter Regan, okay, if you happen to be in, Ithaca, New York, where he is, you might succeed. But, I mean, it is very hard to find an expert witness who will testify that a person is mentally normal or that the psychiatric drugs are harmful. I mean,
I think this conversation is great, and I think that this is the exact problem, though, that anybody who dares to challenge psychiatry or stand up against it is then made to be not credible or lose their stature inside of things, and yet the fraud of psychiatry is allowed to persist. And so it's very, very frustrating. I think for many people who are experiencing this, of trying to find somebody on the ground where they are who would be able to testify on their behalf about this.
Well, here is just one other name, and this is also from Gottstein, and I'll say this right before I run and get my dinner. I'm kind of multitasking between this and some financing stuff I'm working on. But, like, Grace Jackson is a psychiatrist. She's an MD, and she's I understand that she either provides her own testimony or she's provided a medical stamp of approval on Whitaker's pre-filed testimony. Again, please call me out. I'm not I almost failed civil procedure in law school, and that is the extent of my litigation knowledge. But that's sort of what I've been reading. I'll be right back. I'm going to go grab my sushi.
Okay, thanks, Jace, for calling in. I also wanted to just say, area code 252, your line is open. And Catherine, if you're on any of these lines that are holding, please press either 1 or star 1 to pull in. I know that you're elsewhere in the world, and so you might be having some trouble contacting through from where you are, but if you're any of these people who have been holding for more than a half an hour, please press 1 or star 1. Okay. And line 252, your line is open.
Yeah. Hey. I just wanted to say I'm from North Carolina, and you can have a jury for a hearing. And I have had Watson, Grace Jackson, Whitaker's information, but if you hire a lawyer, you're less likely to get that information on the record unless, he's a sympathetic lawyer. And I lost with a lawyer. He would not introduce the information or Toby McGuire's testimony. But when I threatened a jury, when I took it upon myself and said, I want a jury now, they dropped it.
And
so I believe a jury is helpful. And I will say also that if you do speak out about this, you will face retaliation. If you're trying, and I'm advocating for someone else, but And this person had a brain injury diagnosis, and they wouldn't accept that. So if you try to advocate, you will face, in my experience, you will face retaliation.
I think that this is part of the real problem of how people are retaliated against and silenced when they try to speak out and have expert witnesses. And that's terrible that this has happened to you when they didn't actually go through with the jury trial. Just invoking it was enough.
Right, and in other words, saying I'm going to take control, and now this evidence is going to be on the record,
right,
because I'm not going to have a lawyer to shut me up. You see.
And I think that this is part of the problem, is that lawyers really very often, you know, unless they're really allies, either misrepresent themselves. There's a situation in New York where a lawyer actually had worked for the institution and took on a case of somebody who had previously been a lawyer of the institution, that people aren't necessarily upfront about what they're doing. And then this idea of getting people to challenge psychiatry, or for psychiatry, even, you know, even if you left aside for a second all of the issues of whether or not psychiatric diagnosis is valid or reliable, but even the idea of just forcing something on somebody that somebody doesn't want in terms of any kind of quote-unquote medical way is deeply problematic. Aubrey, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share along this lines.
Oh, are you talking to me?
Well,
no.
You
said Audrey?
Aubrey, yeah.
I would echo the sentiment about the jury trial scaring them. In my own situation as well, they had attempted to certify me inappropriately as gravely disabled. They even admitted that's what they were doing, but they were trying to find funds for treatment. I was able to get them to back down by demanding a jury trial, and I demanded it actually pro se, along with starting the clock for my hearing, and I emphasized to the court I wanted representation. I just hadn't received any yet. So I received a court-appointed attorney who was able to afford the jury trial. There was no way around it. I had already filed the demand in writing. And rather than actually face the facts being tested, the case was withdrawn. One thing that happens again, and I'm going to tie this back to my original comments about remembering Beth McCann's name for going after the jury trial, and to my comments about how political power works, is that you have to think of these people as primarily rational self-interested actors. Now, in my own contention, the judge is afraid of one thing, and that's not getting career advancement or of having something come down on them politically or otherwise. If you let someone go and anything happens that can be used against you, whether it's at a confirmation hearing for a higher judgeship or whether it's in a political future you later pursue. On the other hand, there's next to no possible ramifications to you for certifying someone. It's not like you're going to get over or committing someone or upholding a commitment. It's not like you're going to get overturned on appeal, which is one of the only other things judges are afraid of. And the result of that is that all you can really do and all you can really hope to do is scare someone about something that they're interested in. And I continue to assert that for the most part, and yes, it's not never that a bench trial works, but for the most part, the court isn't concerned with you and isn't concerned about your rights or anything else. But going to face a jury trial for the people who are trying to lock you up is a big pain in the ass. They actually have to have a case. Whereas generally, I'm going to go so far as to suggest most of the time, you don't actually need a winnable case as long as people aren't willing to fully exercise their rights or discourage. Demanding a jury trial, and we should spread this word to everyone and make sure everybody, everywhere it's available, knows it, is one of the only ways that we can actually hold them accountable when they're not actually filing a strong case, when they're blurring the rules, which I'm going to again suggest they do all the time, And in Colorado, we had a former nurse at Fort Logan provide testimony to Congress that it's done all the time, that she witnessed it being done. And she worked actually at the state hospital and witnessed doctors bending the rules in order to commit people. So the point that was made, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, who made it, about how asking for a jury trial is incredibly useful at actually freeing yourself is, again, a point of being able to threaten them with something where they might actually be held accountable, as opposed to in Colorado, if you don't demand a hearing, they just do whatever they want to you. Or if you do demand a hearing but just before a judge, again, there's much less fear of accountability. Once you bring that jury in, everybody's watching, and it's a huge pain in the ass. And sometimes it's that accountability, and sometimes it's just the pain in the ass, but it's a great way to free yourself.
Oh, Laura?
Yes, please.
I wanted to say that in my case, it was a guardianship thing. The agency was trying to have guardianship so they could commit this person. And so that's what I was getting the jury for. But I also know of another person in North Carolina who was in a hospital, and she had the hearing, was going to have the hearing to be committed. She demanded a jury trial, and they told her, well, you'll have to wait a week, an extra week. She said, okay. And then she told me they took the hearing outside of the hospital for the jury trial. And of course, when she had the jury, she was not committed.
I mean, and I'm just wondering, though, now, what is this like? Because what happens if the way that you are, I mean, because this is as non-medical as ultimately, I'm not suggesting that we should work against this, but just on this larger idea of, the idea of some group of people being able to determine your quote-unquote mental illness with about as much medical training or evidence as, the lawyer would have or the judge would have, that there's still no, what happens if a jury, if you're living someplace where your attitudes or beliefs or actions are different than the overwhelming majority of people in your town or who would be considered your quote-unquote peers. Like,
well, that's what they threaten you with. They threaten you with that, you see. They say, we could go worse if it's before a jury. And it could, but you're not getting a fair trial in the hospital, period.
No, not at all. I don't think for 2 seconds you are. How can you get a fair trial if they don't admit the evidence that there's no evidence for what they're talking about?
Right. You get an attorney 5 minutes before the hearing who doesn't have any idea what's going on. And that attorney is from the the Attorney General's office is out to commit you in North Carolina. I don't know if that's true everywhere. They send attorneys out to commit you.
Right, because the state has a prosecutor working for them, and then they also are paying very often for an attorney through a free defense, through a mental hygiene legal services or something like that. So they're paying on both ends. So either way, their people win, right? But, I mean, I was at a hearing recently of where I asked why the defending attorney didn't, talk about any of the questioning of psychiatry. And I got snapped at and was told that was a political issue and that wasn't what the hearing was about. And I'm like, well, if you don't get an adequate defense of where the reality of the information, that there's no actual evidence for any of these quote-unquote biological diseases, how are you getting a fair trial in the first place, let alone anything else going on?
There's nothing fair about that hospital hearing at all. And I went as an advocate, and they wouldn't even let me speak. They ran me out of the hospital. They had me removed from the hospital because I had evidence. And then the person that they committed, because she didn't have a jury trial in this case, and they wouldn't let me speak on her behalf, she said, I won't appeal. Well, they're supposed to ask you in North Carolina if you want to appeal. They don't. So she said, I do. And Indigent Defense Counsel, I'll say his name if you want me to, said, we're following your appeal. He never did.
And so what's your recourse when your defense when your defense counsel isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing to protect you.
Was a grievance filed against this attorney who claimed to be filing a document he didn't file?
Well, he's a big guy at the whole Indigent Defense Council for the state. And I've got it in writing that he filed an appeal. And he didn't. And the thing is,
Aubrey, your sound is really off. Are you on a speakerphone, maybe?
Is this any better?
Yes. Go ahead.
I filed with the Bar Association about that attorney. If he said in writing he was filing an appeal, and then he never filed an appeal, that's an attorney not doing their job. They can lose their license for that, or be otherwise sanctioned by the bar. So I would strongly recommend, especially if it's recent enough to matter, that you file a complaint, or if you weren't in the case, that you reach out to the person and get them to file a complaint. Provide where they said they were filing an appeal in writing, and provide the case number, the showing that there's no appeal, no notice of appeal in that case, no appeal filed in a higher court, because the effect of that is, A, it's ineffective assistance of counsel, and B, that's a disbarment offense right there. You can't fuck up and fail to actually defend your client or fail to do something you've represented you're going to do. That happens all the time. I've wondered if papers I was trying to file with the court made it there since I had to give it to the hospital. But if you can ever prove it didn't, then you can pretty much nail someone. And the only way things like this are going to shape up is if we start nailing people.
Yes. And before, if she requested it, they just ignored her. And according to the law, they're supposed to be asking you, do you want to appeal? Not ignoring you when you ask to appeal. So the system is, and you feel very hopeless, especially when you're the person being committed.
Yeah, you can't rely on your public defender. You've got to know your rights. You've got to exercise them yourself, and you've got to make the defender file file things. You've got to make the defender file your jury demand. You've got to make the defender file the appeal. Otherwise, sometimes they're just going to say, you know what, I took this case for the $100 an hour the state pays. Really care.
Well, that's why I went over his head to the head of the Indigent Defense Council. And he says, okay, I'll make sure it's filed. And you've got the person who's drugged. They got their brain just shut down. And they're supposed to be expected to defend themselves. After they ask for an appeal, they're supposed to be expected to pursue that?
No, I think that's unreasonable. Hi, Susan.
There's Catherine, right?
Catherine.
Yeah. I mean, people who are not under stress, people who are not imprisoned or not being drugged, people just going through the stress of a divorce, for example, you know, can't think as well as they normally would. Anyone going through litigation is having a harder time than they normally would, just dealing with life, much less trying to figure out all these statutes. I think when it comes to a lawyer and the client is always, always, always going to be at a disadvantage, sometimes even when the client himself or herself is an attorney. There's just something about the relationship that puts the client one down, at least one down from the lawyer. Back when I practiced law, I just used to hear the most bizarre tales of what people would be told was the law by their lawyers, and people that, you know, if you don't know, it's like, if you don't know plumbing and a plumber comes to your house and tells you, I don't know what kind of, you know, crazy stuff, you know, you're going to think, well, you know, he's a plumber. This is what he does for a living. He must know. You're not going to be, you know, and you're not going to be trying to second guess him. I'm just saying that if a lawyer is at all deceptive or just busy or whatever, the client's going to end up confused. The client really, though the client is the employer, for sure, for sure. The client's the employer, and clients should not forget that. But still, there is a horrible disadvantage because of the difference in the knowledge level, the training. You know, because lawyers can pretty much get away with telling anybody anything. I mean,
kind of like psychiatrists.
Yeah, kind of like the psychiatrist and the patient, you know.
Yeah,
even in private practice, even when a patient is paying and leaves the office and isn't subject to drugging, it's still a disadvantageous relationship for the patient. It's just the nature of it.
Well, and the power dynamic that, you know, that everybody is by some title, and the title that is awarded to the person who is should be the prime focus and have all of the power is something that is severely limited to a less than human kind of status, based on this idea of, you know, fraud presented by the you know, by the psychiatric industry of what it is they're doing. And so, Catherine, I want to thank you for joining us and coming in on the show, and hoping that maybe Aubrey could just very quickly say what the message was that people got that from the robocall. And then, Catherine, if you would give us some insight. And we do have one, I believe it's Wayne, who's got a question coming in, and then maybe, Catherine, you would be able to give us some insight into what you'd like to talk about deeply. So, Aubrey, what was that message that the robocall sent out for Beth McCann?
Give me one sec. I can play it for you.
Oh, okay, great. And so Beth McCann is who we really need to be looking out for. If you live in Colorado, this is the woman who tried to take away the jury trial. And as much as it has risks inside of, you know, who is considered your quote-unquote peers, and as the woman from North Carolina indicated, can be used also in a coercive matter, and, you know, you better watch out that you don't go to a jury over this, that, you know, it's still a fundamental right of Americans to have and to be able to have that. And sometimes just invoking the power of saying, I want a jury trial, is enough to get people to back off. Aubrey, do you have that audio up?
I have the file here. Just taking my computer a sec to grab it. I keep talking for a minute, and then I'll have it up. I'll pipe up when I've got it ready.
Okay, I'm just wondering also if people wanted to get in touch with you, would you give your website address and things like that?
Yes, by all means. The best way to get in touch with me is by email. It's aubrey@aubreyshomo.net. That's AubreyShomo.net. My website's there also, but there's no contact info up on it, so just send an email to Aubrey@AubreyShomo.net. I think I just need to...
That would be great. So that's Aubrey@AubreyShomo.net, and I will post that also on the page that people can get in touch, because this isn't over. You all won, and you got phenomenal media attention, and you were written up in the newspaper, and people focused in on it, and you also got brought attention to the removal of the word imminent, that they were trying to remove imminent from imminent danger to lower the standard for what it was people would be able to get committed for. And I think that, you know, if you stay online and, you know, continue in the conversation as we go through, because I think that this is all, it all ties in as to how people can be done that. And maybe while you're pulling up that audio, Wayne, if you're there, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, Catherine's comment about the plumber just brought something to mind, which my point is, don't believe in experts. In any field, just don't believe in experts. I'm thinking about an occasion when I had an air conditioning system malfunction at a piece of my rental property, and one air conditioning repairman said, you need a new thermostat and you need a new expansion valve. The next one I hired said, no, you don't need any of that. You need a new compressor. The third one said, you don't need any of that. The system's fine. There's so much fraud in the world that you never know whether to believe what an expert is telling you or not. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, I think it's an excellent point. And, you know, Wayne, I did just go on to your website there for the case against psychiatry, and I'm not seeing contact information. So if you could contact me at some future point, or if you have specific, oh, there it is. Okay, at mail.com. You wrote it out. I see it.
Right.
WayneRamsey@mail.com, because I would really like to talk with you further. Yeah.
Lauren, you and I have met before. We met at an ARPA conference a couple of years ago.
You know, I was wondering if maybe that wasn't you or not, but I wasn't sure. Oh, awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for calling in and for getting in touch again.
Okay.
And NARPA, of course, a phenomenal organization, the National Association of Rights Protection and Advocacy. Their conference is very, very informative and a ton of good work. Aubrey, do you have that audio up?
Yes, I do. I hope you guys can hear it. I'm going to actually have to play it through my speakers and then hope that my mic picks it up, but here we go.
You trial by jury for a million Coloradans.
Oh, sorry, let me start it over.
The right to trial by jury for a tax for a million Coloradans. Yes, you heard that right. Tuesday, the Colorado House has set a federal law that allows the government to confine you against parole based on allegations that do not have the vetting of a jury trial. All they have to do is claim someone has a mental illness, and you can be committed, your family broken, your loved ones taken away, all without the protection of a jury. Since 1 in 4 adults in America has a diagnosable mental illness, this proposed law would be a huge loophole right for abuse. Who could possibly be waging this assault on your civil rights? Republicans? No, sadly, it's Democrat Beth McCann. For more information, go to SaveTheJury.org or contact Beth McCann directly at 303-866-2959 and tell her to kill House Bill 1253. Tell her that the right to trial by jury matters to all Americans.
And so what we did is we gave people her contact information, and the site is still up. The site's been repurposed to the campaign to unelect Beth McCann. But we had a contact form on the website that a number of folks chose to use, and we provided her contact information directly if they didn't want to hear it from us so that they could hear it from her. Plus, I figured she would probably tell some political lies about what she was doing and why we could later out her on when we got the press interested. So we started robocalling camp on – we continued it on Monday when the House got back into session. The bill was scheduled for a second reading in the House on Tuesday. What happened is on Monday, while we were still robocalling, I had one of the calls placed directly to Representative McCann's Capitol phone. While they were still robocalling, the calls were going out, they went in and had the bill brought up a day ahead of schedule. For the vote we were talking about, and had the bill killed on the floor that very day. So all it took was notifying a bunch of her constituents, and we took the process. We took the theory that since she's not really afraid of the opposition that had come from conservative groups over this, we called for Democratic and independent voters, not the Republicans, and that got her to kill the bill.
Huh. And how many calls went out?
A great many, tens of thousands. I don't want to give the exact number because I don't want them to be able to gauge the effectiveness of the campaign if the statistic is ever available.
I hear you. Well, that's just phenomenal and super creative and brilliant. And people can go to unelectbethmccann.org. Is that right?
Yeah, that'll work. That basically goes the same place as the Save the Jury site. We have the archives up there of how it was when we were doing the campaign, some of my correspondence with Representative McCann, and right now the site is for the campaign to unelect Representative McCann on the grounds that nobody who thinks coming after the jury trial is remotely acceptable is fit for office. We defeated the bill, but we're afraid they'll try again. So we're now saying anybody who even considers it thinkable. The fact she introduced, which contained Jim, they had thrown together a task force to review the civil commitment law. The task force hadn't recommended the removal of the jury trial. We had testimony again on the floor of the House that there were a couple of provisions that were not recommended by the task force. We had a leaked email from the Legal Center for Older People and People with Disabilities where a task force member had notified them that the task force had not recommended the removal of the jury trial or the removal of the word imminent. So I have a question, Aubrey.
I have a question. I may have missed this, and you may have said it before. Does Colorado have a state constitution right to jury trial in criminal and civil cases?
Yes, it does. So it's not entirely clear whether they would have gotten away with it in the courts, but the troubling thing is that once it's removed from the statute, you've lost a major ground. So it is in the Constitution. The jury trial for civil commitment specifically has been available since before Colorado was a state. But obviously, if you can stop them from changing the law, it's a lot better than trying to fight them in court over it. I believe the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People was saying that there was a possible court challenge to the law, but that did not deter them from trying to proceed with it until the issues were raised by us and by the gun lobby. It was a really sweet opposition there because the gun lobby could speak to the conservative base and the conservatives everywhere. And we took the approach of trying to speak to liberals everywhere and or independents, people, moderates, people in the middle of the road, and say, look, this is a fundamental right. And it's
a constitutional right. I don't see how you can legislate away part of your constitution, although,
well,
of course, we see that happening.
As a circumstance for rights, so there would be a case where you'd argue that what the Constitution does spell out applies to civil commitments, and who knows how a court's going to rule on that? Who knows how the next higher court's going to rule that? Who knows how the state Supreme Court will rule on that? And who knows how the federal circuits will rule on that? So they brought someone in to testify. Who is a forensic psychiatrist and I believe also had legal training, who had claimed that the courts were not likely to oppose what they were trying to do. So they were at least trying to sell that they thought they could win in court. Of course, we tried to claim it would be unconstitutional. But at the end of the day, what prevailed is not how a hypothetical court case would have gone, but how the much sooner election was going to go over it. That's what scared them out of it. Constitutional law is a complicated thing, and it protects a lot less than you think it would, and that's just right now, without having to ask how new cases would be decided.
Right. And I think that's a great transition point into Catherine, if you would give a little bit of an overview of what you've been involved with lately and any which ways that advocacy or activism might be of assistance in these things.
Well, I think that Aubrey's success in fighting the legislation trying to kill the right of jury trial shows how much more of a bang you get for your effort, your bang for your buck or whatever, your political buck, if you advocate within a state as opposed to trying to change something federal. You know, I think that, and I don't know how populated Colorado is exactly, but or if you have a referendum, an initiative process, anything like that, if you have a device for convening a grand jury, anything like that, like the state of Oklahoma has. But those kind of techniques, any device that's in your statutes, in your state constitution that involves real people being able to sign petitions and having it have an actual effect, can make a big difference. In Ohio, I mean, it took a lot of effort. It takes more and more effort all the time to get legislation on the ballot that citizens want. In Ohio, a few years ago, they enacted a constitutional amendment called the Health Freedom Amendment that would prohibit the government, the state from forcing people to obtain treatment. It's a wonderful amendment. It's never been tested, and then like Aubrey was saying, you never know how those things are going to turn out. But citizens put that through. The newspapers in Ohio, to just about everyone, the corporate media, were going on and on about how, oh my God, we can't have this. We can't have a Health Freedom Amendment in Ohio because, you know, all the crazy people would be, you know, we couldn't control them then, you know, if they could actually have a choice, if they couldn't be compelled to be treated. And so people knew that. It was all over the newspapers, vote it down, vote it down, vote it down. And but people voted it in by about, I don't know, 60%. I think this went in effect in 2011, not that long
wow.
ago.
Wow. So the Health Freedom Amendment so that people can't be, but yet people are being forced, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah, well, there's an organization in Ohio that specifically advocates for issues that touch on the Constitution, but they've been leery of touching some of our issues because, oh my gosh, you know, we want to be able to use the Health Freedom Amendment, but we're scared to use it. We're scared to test it in the courts because we're afraid of what the court might do to our constitutional amendment, so it just sort of sits there on the shelf. Now, apparently it was used, the threat of it, sometimes the threat of using something is better than actually using it. The threat of it was used by the 1851 Center, which is the organization that advocates for the Ohio Constitution, in the case of an Amish child.
Hello? Catherine? Hello? Anybody?
I lost her, too.
Hi. Oh, geez, she's gotten cut off mid-sentence. I'm not sure how that happened, but I hope she will call back in a moment. And so the number, Catherine, if you're looking for it, is 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167. But I think that this, you know, the idea of, so if I'm understanding, because I'm not a lawyer, so I'm just trying to catch up here. So if even though there was this health amendment, Health Freedom Amendment law passed, that people aren't using it because they're afraid because of the discrimination. If you know, heaven forbid, challenge psychiatry or the validity of psychiatry, that people don't know the way that it's going to wind up going, and it might wind up cramping down further on a loss of civil liberties, even though it was supposed to protect them. Would that be around?
They're afraid, well, we can't use it to protect the little Amish girl whose parents don't want to force cancer drugs on her. And they're afraid, you know, that it won't be useful for that, which they use the threat of it for that. And as a result, just the threat of it got the government guardian who was trying to cram this treatment down this child's throat to back off. So
okay.
It wasn't tested, though. They brought out the big gun. You know, we might use it. And everybody dispersed.
I want to emphasize that point that you just made, that sometimes the threat of using something alone is sufficient, sometimes even better than the use of it. Because I would dare suggest that the reason this happens to our population, again, is that we're perceived as powerless. So if you've got something like that you can threaten to use, sometimes it's enough to alter the perception that you are powerless to get them to back down. Sometimes they behave very much as a bully would, and all you have to do is bare some teeth, and they will go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So I, in the situations of where it's being forced or in issues of you know, judicial accountability of how these judges get to behave inside of these processes. Would you be willing to talk about that a little bit, or, you know, something else that I know that
especially this being an election year, many places, some places judges are appointed, but in a lot of places, like in Ohio, they are elected. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, oftentimes being elected means that they're running unopposed, too. There needs to be accountability in any profession with that kind of power. I think police officers should have accountability that is not about self-governing, you know, about self-policing. And the same goes with lawyers, I think, and with judges, that it should not be self-policing. One of the things that is, and the other thing I think you and I talked about was that if you want to inspire confidence among the public in the judiciary, you don't make those complaint tribunals off limits, you know, confidential. You don't hide those. People are automatically suspicious of what is hidden from them. And yet you hear, oh, we have to hide it so the public won't lose confidence in us.
Right. Because if they knew what was actually going on, then we would have a real problem on our hands, and then the question seriously starts. I do think area code 212, Catherine, if you just hang on there for a second, because 212, your line is open.
Oh, hey, it's Jake Minus again. Hi, Catherine. My name's Jake. I'm a corporate attorney in New York. So I've already demonstrated my ignorance of civil and criminal procedure and other matters, but, you know, I'm a pretty smart guy, and I did well in law school and all that. So I wanted to talk to you about a few things. One is, you know, I read that you're active in the Rohrer case at the Ohio Supreme Court. I pulled the complaint and skimmed it. And, you know, although I'll tell you, like I'm, you know, on principle opposed to any kind of involuntary treatment, but I also got to tell you, I'm not that sympathetic with that guy, because he got found not guilty by reason of insanity. So it's like, you know what I'm going to say next, right?
Yeah, well, there's automatically a conflict between, you know, having the NGRI plea and then claiming that, you know, you want to be autonomous, but in a way too, there is such a thing as temporary insanity, not necessarily in Ohio, but a person can be not culpable at one period of time because of certain factors, which, if you read the complaint in his case, was because of psychotropic drugs that are known to cause or contribute, not cause necessarily, but are highly associated with violence. I mean, I think we're all well aware of the antidepressant drugs and being associated with the school shooting cases.
And Catherine, I'm wondering, and Jake, if you just hang in there with us for a minute, if you would give a little bit of a background, because I think John, you know, as an individual, and this whole idea of not guilty by reason of insanity is there's somebody who has a background speaker on or something like that. If you could turn your sound down or a speakerphone, because it's causing a lot of feedback. But I think that it's so important for people to realize the dehumanization that comes associated with that, and how immediately there is how problematic the NGRI is. And so if you would just give a little bit of background on your involvement with that and how you know, your perspective of it. And I know that an article just came out on Mad in America today also about this by Sharon Kressinger, and I'm hoping that she's going to join in on the conversation also. So, Catherine, if you could just give a little background.
Okay, well at the point of where that case is, of course, there's the NGRI is done. I mean, there's no really taking it back. So it's done, but I think it's important for people to understand that it's hardly a real blessing to anyone because of it doesn't really – it's not like you go to a country club afterwards.
Right.
You know, it's – and I think the public still is thinking in terms of – some of the shooting of Reagan, whoever that defendant was.
Hinckley.
I think a lot of, who was it?
John Hinckley.
John Hinckley, right. And I think that's when people said, oh no, we can't have that, you know. So even though we're going to maybe not find people guilty, we're going to punish them in other ways.
Right.
And so I think...
Oh no!
One of the things that we always put out is that people don't necessarily realize prior to going into this kind of agreement, and especially even in like the mental health courts where there's like jail diversion kind of stuff going on, that people don't realize that you know that they do their time for this in the criminal system and it's done. But if you go in on any kind of mental health thing, that this could go on for decades past what a sentence would have been, and
oh,
that, this,
absolutely.
That you may never ever
more.
Get out
yeah.
of, you may never ever get out of that. So what somebody might have done in time for 6 months can easily turn into 6 years or the rest of their lives if they're hooked into psychiatry in this way. I just want to remind people that your lines are open, and so anything that you're doing in the background is coming across over the air. So either if you can mute yourself, or if you're not talking, or something like that.
Lauren, this is the next point that I was going to ask Catherine about is like, you know, I'll lay my cards on the table. Like, you know, I follow SOAS pretty strictly on this. There's no such thing as medical mental illness. There's you know, people who are who they are. They have an existential condition that they're a certain way or another. I also agree that. That when you get found not guilty by reason of insanity, you're basically choosing your punishment. You're choosing whether you want to be punished through the overt penal system, or you want to be punished through the mental health system. So like, and I didn't read the complaint that thoroughly, admittedly. But my question to Catherine is like, first of all, if he's like, you know, saying the neuroleptics made me do it, which to me, I got to tell you.
Not neuroleptics, antipsychotics. And he's not saying that. He's saying it was a factor. There were a lot of other factors. He had been severely beaten immediately before on the head. He had been vomiting. He was placed in an extremely violent home where a group home where he was being assaulted by many people constantly. It was just a way of life. It's not.
Yeah,
it wasn't
but,
that much different.
But
than
those. I mean, again, let's just ignore the mental illness angle. In a traditional view, I have a tough life is like it mitigates punishment. It's not an affirmative defense. So all these
exactly.
things, I get what
well,
you,
yeah,
I get what you're
mitigating.
Saying is. Because like if someone beats if Johnny beats me over the head and I end up beating Sally over the head because of that, Sally still gets a right to see me do some time. So the sorts of things like correct me, someone who's more up on the medicine. I thought neuroleptics and antipsychotics were the same thing, just depending on whether.
Yeah.
I thought okay, well.
No, but they can both cause akathisia. And I think they can both cause a mania. I know that the antipsychotics cause
wait,
mania. But the thing is, what you have
the same
yeah, Catherine,
difference.
Please, Jace, let Catherine respond.
That wasn't me.
Oh, sorry.
There's there, different states have different rules, and I want to just say too, you know, I'm not a practicing attorney now. I've only been acting as a paralegal in the case. I have practiced law for many years, but I'm not currently. So, but I want to say, you know, other different states have different rules. At one time in our history, you entered a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, automatically you went to a mental institution. That is not the law of the state of Ohio. The law of the state of Ohio, and I think this is pretty well supported by federal constitutional principles, is that the person has to be not competent at the time. The person has to be mentally ill, and within the definition of mentally ill, whatever that is, in the statute, before they can be sent for treatment involuntarily. Now, the rules are it's easier to get someone who's just pled not guilty by reason of insanity into a mental institution the way the statute in Ohio is set up. But still, the state has the burden. Before the state takes away your liberty for any reason, and remember, an NGRI plea means you're acquitted. You're acquitted. If we don't like that rule, then let's revoke it. But that is the law.
Well,
in just about every place. So if we don't like it, let's take it away. But anyway, that's the law. Then after that, then we look at not what was the mental condition at the time of the act, but what's the law at the time of sentencing or the time of the commitment hearing. So what is the mental status? So the mental status being if the person is not sufficiently mentally ill that they couldn't be committed, then they shouldn't be committed. You know, putting someone into a hospital and spending taxpayer money on it and then forcing them into treatment, is that really – who is that helping exactly? If we're concerned that the person
needs
to be isolated, then let's
But what I'm saying is that I don't think
let's convict him of a crime then. Let's eliminate the NGRI plea.
That's sort of where I am. And what I'm saying is that this is not, you know, my views in particular. This is like, and I think probably I don't need to take a vote of hands, but I think most of us on the line probably follow SOS, which is that and you know his dogma was that abolition of involuntary psychiatry, which is probably all psychiatry, goes hand in hand with abolition of the insanity defense, because with freedom comes responsibility. With freedom comes responsibility. And, you know, the question I had about whether they're antipsychotics or neuroleptics is, first of all, you know, it sounds like some Twinkie defense stuff to me. It's like I ate a bad thing that made me do some bad things, and now I'm better. And now that I've done this.
I think you can't underestimate the long and evidence base of the association of psychiatric drugs with violence. And I think that can't go unacknowledged. And I think that that's a major piece that people don't want to acknowledge, that these drugs are actually causing people to become violent.
Agreed. But take away the mental illness angle. Just talk about doing drugs, like generally. And again, if you commit a murder,
the psychiatric drugs in specific, because these are different from illicit drugs in terms of the idea that a doctor is prescribing and often forcing you to take it. Whereas with illicit drug use, it is a usually voluntary thing that is occurring where somebody is actively seeking it out. So it's two different things.
Right. That led to my next question in this case, which is, you know, if you are compelled to ingest something that reduces your inhibitions to do certain bad things or increases your propensity to do it, one of the critical things is whether you knowingly and voluntarily ingested those substances.
Exactly.
So that's
the longstanding law. Involuntary intoxication versus voluntary intoxication.
Yeah, so, Roar,
voluntary
my question
intoxication
was,
is generally not a defense, but involuntary intoxication is.
Yes. So if you know, I guess it's a gray area. If you are not compelled by court order to take psychotropic drugs, but you know, everyone's telling you it's a really good idea and it'll make you better, and it makes you worse.
Well, a doctor's authority would be enough for that also,
yes.
Probably. And I just want to also
say... That's a well-recognized defense is involuntary intoxication due to a doctor's prescription, because most people don't have what it takes to stand up to the doctor and say, I'm not going to take this. And especially if the doctor's telling you, oh, don't pay attention to those feelings that you're having behind this drug. It's good for you. It's good for you.
Right.
Yeah, again,
so what are you supposed to do?
Again, the reason why I think there's some Twinkie defense stuff going on here is that, people with diagnosed psychoses are no more likely to commit crimes than anyone else. They're much more likely to be crime victims.
This is a different thing. This is not the same thing. They're using this terminology because they have no evidence of any of it, but it's not in any way the same thing. This is a drug-induced state that from withdrawal that causes once you introduce a drug into the brain, you certainly have changed the chemistry of what's going on.
I understand. But what I'm saying is
involuntary intoxication has been recognized for many, many years, Jake.
Yeah, but I understand. But there's a question of but-for causation. Plenty of people go on withdrawal through psychotropics and don't freak out and beat people's heads in. This goes back to my same point. This sounds like a mitigation of punishment. Like, I have a tough life. I got kicked around as a kid. Most people get kicked around.
I think that you're fundamentally, missing some of the point here of how this is occurring. And I hope that everybody will stay on. But area code 330, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren.
Hey, this is Sharon.
It's Sharon. Yeah, it's Sharon from Ohio.
Hi,
how
Sharon.
Are you?
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Sharon, would you give us a little insight from your perspective of how to respond to these kinds of things?
Well, I don't, have any legal background at all, so I can't respond really to any of that at all. But I do want to go back a few minutes in this conversation. I'm not even sure who made the statement. Do you want to be punished in the legal system, or do you want to be punished in the psychiatric system? And ultimately and theoretically, the purpose of the psychiatric system is therapeutic. It's not intended to be a punishment for anything. And I think that... the whole NGRI piece is really huge. I think there are a lot of people out there who are being punished in the psychiatric system, not only because they were found not guilty by reason of insanity, but people who are committed for other reasons. But that is just, I think that's really the bottom line here. It's not supposed to be a punishment to be in psychiatric treatment. It's supposed to be therapeutic.
But the reality is something
not.
Else.
Right.
Right.
I think we know that it's not.
I think that the overarching fact of when it gets into these kinds of things about, I don't know, maybe it's just a factor of the way lawyers talk and I just can't hack it because I'm not a lawyer and I don't get some of this fundamental stuff. But, John is a person, and he is a person who may have had this experience, but the idea that he is not being allowed to be involved in, what is happening to his body currently, and that whatever the process, that he is one person that is going through this who is being public about it, and that there are so many people who are being subject to this, and so many more people who are being subject to this who have never done anything that could be considered, requiring any kind of legal plea in any shape, form, or whatever. And so this idea of where the judges and how the judges are coming in and making decisions and when they're doing it in terms of political favor versus, justice, where is justice? And again, I'm talking as a non-lawyer, right? But, I think for people to really grasp what it is somebody has to go through once they are involved in these kinds of processes is so important, and to remember the humanity inside of this, I think, is just urgent. And I think that when it gets to these really hot button issues, you know, of what is what, and, you know, and Jake, on some levels, I agree with you. I have been really outspoken about getting rid of the not guilty by reason of insanity defense. But then there's this other issue of being intoxicated with drugs that a doctor is telling you to take, which you're saying are causing these things, and the doctor is denying that and telling you that, you know, it's further evidence of your psychosis if you suggest that this stuff is poison, and gives you a greater way of being able to be forced into it. And then, you know, and so I think that there's some other level of something going on here. But certainly the idea of, you know, the prolonged, you know, effects of it, and then what you have to deal with in terms of the jury, and how that all works out. There is an internet caller on the line, maybe through Skype. Your line is open.
It's not me, is it?
No. Perhaps. I'm. If so, maybe it is Catherine. Can you? Yeah.
Is it me?
Hello. Is this Catherine?
Yeah, this is Catherine. Yeah.
Yeah, it may be you. I'm sorry.
Okay,
I don't know
how you
would like to. Yeah, I'm not sure how you would like to respond, or Sharon, if you want to give some insight into the article that just came out, or.
Well, I just, you know, I don't think that one has to completely understand all of the legalities of John's case to understand that he should not be assaulted. I mean, if he had been convicted, found competent, or, you know, however we say, and he had gone to prison to serve his sentence in prison, you know, theoretically he's not allowed to be assaulted in prison. And, you know, we know that he's being assaulted, and we know that his, you know, humanity is being disrespected. And as an activist, that is really the bottom line for me, and that is really why I wanted to, you know, do the piece on John for Mad in America and meet him and, you know, have that conversation with him. And a little bit, you know, further even on some of that stuff that I wrote about in the article about the sort of non-therapeutic groups and things like that, I think it's a huge issue, not just an NGRI issue, but a psychiatric systems issue and a movement issue around, you know, what is being provided for people as so-called therapeutic and billed out at, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars daily and weekly in some of these institutions like Appalachian Behavioral Health here in Ohio, and it's nothing. I mean, it's providing nothing, and it's a huge money mill, you know, for these groups where people do word searches and where people are asked how their day was and where people talk about topics that are never, you know, in this lifetime going to be relevant to people who are psychiatrically incarcerated. And I just think there's, you know, so much to be said about that and so much to be, you know, uncovered about that corruption and that, you know, kind of politicking. And I don't know. That's kind of where my thought ends with that. But
I think there's just something wrong with a society that incarcerates its citizens at the rate that the United States does compared to any other country, you know.
We definitely have to agree.
But that's a consequence of the war on drugs, or, you know, the war on some drugs.
The war on some drugs.
Yeah.
The war on street drugs, not the war on psychiatric drugs. We have, full-blown, funded support for the psychiatric drugs, and it gets bigger and bigger every day. And I think drugs are drugs.
Right. And, you know, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America is sponsored by many of the major pharmaceutical industries. And so it really is, the way that psychiatry gets to prevail inside of this. I think Area Code 202, I know you have a question that I think is really important to ask and see if there are any answers to. Your line is open?
Yes, this is Yvonne Smith. I want to ask a question because I have I'm in the bedroom of a state hospital. I live in the bedroom of a state hospital, and I go there quite frequently every month. And there are people that have been there for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And not all of them, but many of them are not guilty by reason of insanity at St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C. How does a person get out once they have been under system? And I know, I have known people who have had like a felony, less than felony conviction, and they've been documented on the internet maybe of, stealing some jewelry or something, and they were NGRI, and they're just stuck. And they do have good, and some of them may be on this public defenders may be listening in. They're trying to get them out. What is the secret to getting these people out? I have a friend who's been in it 25 years, and he has the hope that he might go to a group home maybe in about a year. What has to be done? What's the strategy? And I'll listen.
Well, we wish we knew. For most people, if there was, I don't know about most people, but oftentimes, though, if you look at the original proceeding, assuming that the state has some kind of a burden of proof to establish that they were that they needed treatment, I think it's very common in commitment hearings, whether it's in probate court or after an NGRI plea. It's real common for these proceedings to consist of one psychiatrist, maybe, and nobody else. Sometimes,
less of a standard than the ability to commit somebody, which would need to be two psychiatrists, right? So if it's only one psychiatrist, it actually has a lesser standard.
Or oftentimes these hearings will take 30 seconds, a minute and a half. How do you take away someone's freedom in a minute and a half?
But I'm asking.
In John's case, they took his freedom in about 45 seconds.
But once the person has been committed and they go to court, these people go to court every 6 months or so often. They are so hopeful. They go before the judge. And I'm not talking, these are people that are compliant. I listen at grand rounds at the doctors and the psychologists act as if in their frustration of the people being, getting people to be active in treatment. Now, there are many people that don't want to take the medications because they have had severe reactions. I'm talking about where the twitching is something unmistakable, where they've been crippled. But there are many of these people who are very compliant. They take the medication. They go to the groups. They see the psychiatrist. And they still are there for long lengths of time. And who does the judge listen to? Is the judge listening to the doctor? What's holding them?
Well, what the doctor is saying, he still needs treatment. And even if the patient is eloquent sometimes, especially a patient that's not represented, and I wonder how many of these people have an attorney in these review hearings. They're lucky if they have an attorney for the original commitment.
Well, we've done some advocacy, and they all public the public defenders here at say they're doing their best. I mean, they're on the side of the guy. Many of them would say that, you know, mental illness doesn't exist or whatever else. They're on the side of the people. And I just wonder, who does the judge listen to? That's what I'm asking. Is the judge listening to is it the psychiatrist the person we have to convince, or is it the judge?
I think the status of the person and the more affiliated with the government they are, the more they'll be listened to. You know, the statement is live and well in legal proceedings.
Well, yeah, and they listen to the psychiatrist and they listen to you know, whoever is in power, and if the people who are voting them in want people to vote in a certain way, that's the way they go, right? That this is the politicking of it. This is how, you know, what they're swayed by. Area code 703, your line is open.
Oh, hello, Lauren. This is Diane Angster calling.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Hi, Diane.
Hey, Diane. I'm doing okay. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you for calling in. Do you have a question or a comment that you'd like to share?
Well, I was going to comment on what happened here in Virginia. Many years ago, you know, we kind of started a campaign to reform the NGRI system. And we had a very hard time, but when some of the people were asking, like Yvonne was asking, well, how do people get out? What do they do? Well, in a lot of states, it's different states. But in Virginia, for instance, there's a board that hears people's cases, or that where the hospital, let's say if you're in the Northern Virginia Institute and you're NGRI, then you have to send your paperwork to this board in Richmond, and they look at your paperwork and review it, and then they will either grant it or not grant your release. And it's statutorily set up this way, and it can be changed through the political process. I mean, it's kind of like a parole board or, you know, any other kind of board like that where it's set up under statute and the procedures are set up. And if enough people complain about it, then it can be changed. And what we did in Virginia, now we had a very hard time because Virginia is a very conservative state. But we were able to change the law, and we just did this by changing the statute, and we got sponsor in the legislature to submit it. And what we did was is that we passed the law in Virginia that if you committed a misdemeanor offense and you pleaded NGRI, that when you were then put into the state hospital, you have to be released within a year. So that meant that anybody who was, you know, pled guilty or pled NGRI on an offense that was a misdemeanor, that was a minor offense, for misdemeanor offenses, you can only be held for a year. And most of the people go to jail, local jail, and serve their time if it's a criminal offense. So we were able to pass in Virginia saying that if it's a misdemeanor, they can't hold you any longer.
You know, that's interesting because I'm going to make my point again that acknowledges that treatment is punishment because
wait a second.
No, hold on a second. General rule is that, you know, a misdemeanor offense, you can't do, the definition of a misdemeanor is you can't be incarcerated for more than a year. I think that's a constitutional principle. And so they're saying since we can't incarcerate you for more than a year, we can't quote unquote treat you for more than a year.
That was the limit.
I'm not talking about what should be. I'm talking about what is.
No. That was the limit that a person could be held. That was a limit. If you wanted to hold a person longer than that, then you would have to go through the regular commitment process and show that he was, at the time, it was an imminent danger to himself or others. But I don't want to argue the part about whether NGRI is a good thing or not, because I don't think that's what we're talking about. At least that's not what Sharon's article was about. I think Sharon's article and the situation that John in is whether, given as Ms. Hines was saying, given the fact that we do have NGRI and people are then placed in an institution, how should they be treated? And
they
this level
be treated,
system,
right,
this
with
level
human
system
rights.
Is horrible.
It really is, and I think that, you know, Diana, I so appreciate you calling in, and that's interesting in Virginia of what you were able to accomplish, and I would love maybe on another night to actually go through that process to educate people about ways that have worked to make significant changes in law and such. But I think that, you know, the H.R. 3717, the Murphy Bill, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, that everybody needs to be aware of how this connects, because even though it's not NGRI straight up, the creation, part of what H.R. 3717 creates is veterans courts that would combine criminal mental health and drug and alcohol as alternatives to the traditional court system. And so for veterans to be aware of the fact that they may think that they're getting the same way people who go to either mental health court and don't realize that, you know, that the sentence isn't a fixed sentence and that this could go on for the rest of your life and that you may never, ever get out if you go down this road. And that, you know, veterans are also going to be subject to this if H.R. 3717 passes, and to be kind of warned of this process. But when, you know, regardless of what gets a person involved with psychiatry in terms of involuntary psychiatry, inside of those processes, people should absolutely be treated with human rights and the ability to make decisions and the ability to refuse and to not be assaulted and dragged down to the floor and shot up with drugs when they are refusing them. You know, and so, yeah, you know, I'm here. I may not be able to leave here, but while I'm here, I should be able to decide what happens inside of my body. And that right, as far as I understand, is what's been taken away and what it is that needs to be protected. Catherine, would that be accurate?
It's de facto taken away. Actually, when a person's hospitalized, the hospitalization is supposed to be to protect the public if they're dangerous. But the forced drugging, that's supposed to be just for their own good. That's part of that parents' patriae power,
the
police power.
In Virginia, attorney Jonathan Martinez actually did a case for us locally, and the court ruled that people who were committed still had the right to refuse medication. So that also differs by jurisdiction.
Right. By jurisdiction, right.
Well, that's the basic rule in Ohio.
Okay. I want people to know that, because a lot of people don't know that. They think that if a person is committed that you can then give them whatever drugs you want, and there's no chance for informed consent. And it's not true in Virginia.
Right. And
what the law is in Ohio, as I understand it, is that they can, if you're an imminent danger, and that's the key, imminent danger, you know, of hurting someone, they don't even need a court order. They can just take you down and you know, restrain you chemically, physically, whatever. If it's truly self-defense, if it's truly an emergency, but they can only do that for the duration of the emergency.
That's right. That's
they can't do it as a course of treatment.
That's
when you
correct,
get into
yes.
a course of treatment, then you have to show that that the person can't consent, that the person it's in their best interest, and that there's no alternatives.
Yes.
And there's always alternatives better than drugging.
So that's the biggest illegitimacy. And I think that gets us right back to what was going on in Colorado with when they were trying to take away the jury trial, also trying to remove the standard of imminent from imminent danger. And so now that they lower the standard, they make it easier for anybody to be, you know, subjected to this. And what is an imminent danger? And we're still working inside a very subjective kinds of terms that anybody in
That's
power can then manipulate and turn into somebody, a situation of where somebody is being forcibly psychiatrized and assaulted with these drugs and other kinds of procedures and practices. Eric, we have just 2 minutes left. Area code 330, you've been waiting online. Do you have a quick comment or question?
I just want to thank you very much. Yeah, I wanted to get that thing from about Catherine from the state of Ohio, what the freedom thing was. And most importantly is I know a veteran that was, he was geeked out on meth and he was out in the woods with an assault weapon and they had to put him in treatment because he was dangerous. So, you know, sometimes it's necessary that these things are taken care of. So that, you know,
I think that this point is seriously debatable. I think that the idea of violence and treatment are two different things, and that we need to keep on separating them. I do want to thank Aubrey and Catherine for coming on. I think that we may go off air, but if people want to stay online, it'll continue to record, and so people can hear the after conversation in the archive at a later date, just to wrap up. But I wanted to, just before the show goes off air officially, I wanted to just thank everybody for participating. And so, David, I hear your point about, that there are some alternatives that could be available to veterans who may be having some kind of struggle, and that sometimes, helping somebody is necessary in some kind of terms. But I think that, again, what psychiatry is offering and what they're able to do isn't going to be help, and it's not going to be legitimate. And the idea of people walking out from a traditional court hearing thinking that they're going to get off on some psychiatric term and that it's going to be, whatever, is part of the problem. But Catherine, I'm wondering if you would respond or have any thoughts about this in wrapping up.
I'm saying if the person is out in the woods and shooting somebody, if he's committing a criminal act, then there's a criminal. We have plenty of criminal statutes that provide for that person to be isolated from society, but we don't incarcerate people for what they might do for future crime because they might do something. If they've done it,
right.
If they've done a crime, then we've decided that incarceration, for violent crimes is what we want to do, then that's what we do. I don't think hospitals should be used for that. That's what, prisons are for.
Could I make a point here, Lauren? I didn't really understand what you were saying about veterans courts. I mean, veterans courts, to me, I thought they were similar to mental health courts.
Right.
And mental health courts are criminal courts.
Right, but where somebody is getting to some degree agreeing to treatment as part of their, as Jake was saying before, punishment for whatever it was they were doing. And so when you just go through a straight criminal court, you get a sentence that with the idea that you behave appropriately inside of jail, whatever that means, when your sentence is over, your sentence is over. But if you go through a mental health court, that this could go on for decades.
Wait a second. I don't think so.
It depends on your state. I mean, like in Ohio.
Because you're constantly subjected to having to defend your thing. And so if you're in a place where they believe that once involved with psychiatry, always necessary to be involved with psychiatry, then you don't want to comply with your treatment, then you're consistently mandated to be involved because they immediately do this pre-positioning you as a danger to self or others based
no,
on...
No, no,
no.
Those are different standards.
I understand it.
I mean, are you comparing it to NGRI? Or are you comparing it to a regular commitment hearing? Or are you comparing it to, a mental health court? I mean, in a mental health court, the court only retains jurisdiction for a certain period of time. It's not like NGRI where it goes on and on and on forever.
Well, I'm not sure, but I've had
people
talk to me.
I'm not familiar with those. We don't have those, I don't think.
Well, in New York, I've had people, make complaints to me about the fact that they can't get out of mental health court because they don't comply with the medication, that they keep on getting further sentences of where they're then under other involuntary involvement with psychiatry, and so that it never really ends. But, I mean, that could be, that's neither here nor there, ultimately, mm-hmm. but... I do think that people need to be aware of when they're going through a court process and they think that they're going to be getting something better than jail or prison when they go down a psychiatric route, that they should be warned that it's very hard to get out of that afterwards, whereas when you complete your actual sentence, if it was just through a criminal court, it's over and done, and you've done your time and you're out. With a psychiatric, that doesn't happen.
Okay, well, that certainly is something then maybe. I mean, maybe you should just do other shows on how they work, but I think they work differently in different jurisdictions.
Yeah,
and,
they do.
My understanding is, in the mental health courts that I'm familiar with, is that the court has jurisdiction over a certain time period. Now, if you, for instance, decide that you're not going to comply with whatever mental health treatment you've agreed to, then you just go back into the criminal system, as you would.
Except you're now involved with psychiatry, and so see, but New York is a state that has involuntary outpatient commitment laws, so that might be one of the differences. Is that once you're in that, you're also, you know, key for involuntary outpatient commitment. And now they've made a law, as a matter of fact, if you've ever been incarcerated, if you're incarcerated, that you have to go through an involuntary outpatient commitment screening before you are released from prison or jail. And then if you qualify for Kendra's law, then you are subject to it.
Not just for sex offenders.
No, not just for students. No, across the board. It passed the Senate, and it was moved to the Assembly. And so now we're waiting on that to find out.
The thing about it is that the country looks to New York as an example, like Kendra's law. That's the dangerous part about it, is they keep looking to New York as a model. And that's why we have to pay attention to not just what's going on in our jurisdiction, but what's going on in these leader states, because there are other people that we know that don't mean us any well, and they use that as a model to say that this is what is helping people who have mental illness, this is what is protecting the public. So even though a lot of this stuff is new, even the veteran mental health courts, and maybe it'd be a good idea to have some other panelists on to talk about this veteran situation, because people don't understand it. Just as Aubrey was saying, that we may not like it, but 26% of the people have at some time in their life had some kind of mental health counseling or treatment. It may not be medication. It might be grief counseling. It might be one time only because somebody on their job committed suicide. But the fact is that 26% of the people, they always said one out of four, and half the people in the United States would be subject to having their liberty taken away from. So we need to pay attention to it, and it's not right that this happens to our veterans.
The 26% statistic is at any given time. I think lifetime prevalence of a diagnosis, of receiving a diagnosis, is something like 50% now.
Right, but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
we
so,
also have
so.
To, every time we say any of this, I think we must, you know, as that we must say that this is all fraudulent. This is a fraudulent diagnosis that has no evidence behind it, that there is no legitimacy to any psychiatric diagnosis in terms
well,
of...
Lauren, I hear you loud and clear. However, just as the person was saying about not going before the judge and trying to say that psychiatry doesn't exist. What happens is the judges are listening to behavioral health, and they're saying that you have agnosthesia or whatever that illness is. So it might not be a good defense. The fact is, we're in a situation in this country, in the United States, where it's much like people that were in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and people don't understand it. If the pendulum swings, anyone. And what Diane is saying about the 50%, that is the reason why we need to talk to people, so they need to understand this. It could be anybody.
I'm not disputing what Diane is saying. I'm just disputing the idea that that's statistic. I think what Diane is saying.
I said
is
received
point,
a diagnosis. I said received a diagnosis.
Right,
I didn't say.
I wasn't disputing, Diane, I wasn't disputing what you were saying. I'm just reminding people who may not be aware of these issues and just hear people talking, you know, just people who are tuning in.
Okay.
I'm not in any way disputing. Yeah, absolutely. Half of the population is subject to this at some point in their life, and so to educate them, but in that same term.
And somebody, one time had some counseling. Well, that could include someone who at one time, when I used to do mental surveys, I was a project manager for surveys.
Right. And
years. They had one encounter.
There's quite a lot of background noise. It's very, and it may be because we're running so much over time here. I'm not sure if the machine is picking up different. But I'm counting
one encounter with the mental health system, they could be counted there. So when you were talking about you being subject to this because you have a mental health diagnosis, it's the fact that you could have one encounter. You could have a parent who is in hospice care. That's getting hospice care. And you could go for counseling because that's part of the rest, and you could be included in that 26% to 50%. So,
Can I ask a question? I have a very specific question. I've heard this term, received a diagnosis. What is, this is some more
because
lawyer,
it's an assignment.
No. What I'm asking is, what does the word received mean?
It means that you've been given.
They attach to you something that was on a medical code. So if you, for some reason, like I said, grief, someone was in a hospice, maybe someone on your job committed suicide, they brought everyone in. For them to code and to get paid, they have to say that you have something. Common diagnosis is anxiety. So you receive a diagnosis so they can bill and get paid. So in this country, you can't go to somebody because you need support about some temporary thing happening. They have to say there's something wrong with you.
So the word, with evidence, and I'm asking this, I'll tell you the reason I'm asking in a second. Received means some guy billed insurance using a DSM code. Is that a fair summary? The reason why I'm asking is it, and by the way, I've read patient files that people I know have demanded, you know, pursuant to Freedom of Information Act type provisions or form equivalents where you have a right to see your files. And a lot of times it'll just say some made up stuff about, you know, patient exhibits this and this and that, affective disorder or whatever, but it doesn't contain, you know, this person has this disorder. And so when people are concerned about labeling, what makes the label stick is that you went and sought treatment and either to your insurer or Medicare or Medicaid, someone submitted a claim with a code that ties to the DSM. Is that right? Is that what makes you receive a diagnosis, insurance
billing? Well, you can also receive a diagnosis if you just go to somebody and pay out of pocket and you ask them for a diagnosis. If you go to a mental health professional and you're not being, it doesn't go to insurance or anything, and you just say, I'm coming to you because I want to know if there's something wrong with me, and then the person gives an assessment. And, of course, we're all realizing that this is all, you know, within their framework, not our framework, but so they can do an assessment as they are supposed to do under their profession.
Right, I'm Diana. Are you there?
We might be going off air.
Yeah, it may be getting cut off. Catherine, I'm wondering if another time maybe we can spend the while. The lines were just jam packed tonight, all night long, and I think that the issues are so not often talked about that to try to get to the nitty gritty of things would really take quite a bit. And I know that perhaps sometime John is going to be coming on also in the future and talking about things from his perspective, and maybe just getting some of these other issues,
yes,
and also talking
great.
About. Also talking about the child advocacy stuff and the retaliation when people try to protect children who are being abused. I think, you know, we tried really hard to get so much jammed in such a short period of time, and, maybe we can schedule this. And for anybody listening, we're going to continue the conversation tomorrow night on Open Lines. And so if you'd like to further contribute, David or Yvonne, Diane, Aubrey, Jason, Ray, Wayne, and anybody else who's called in, and all the people who have been listening in all night long, thank you so much. And I want to ask you all to keep on speaking out. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
Thanks, Lauren. Good night.